Hi, and welcome to the next in our series of What's Next in Corporate Real Estate. My name is Michael Creamer, and it's my pleasure to be doing today's show. It's a first for me. I don't have anyone in the studio with me at Cushman, but rather I have Dror Poleg on the line from New York. Welcome, Dror.
Hi, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
Great. Nice to have you. And I guess it's probably appropriate that we're doing it this way, because what we're going to talk about today has a lot to do with how tech's, I was going to say, frustrating and disrupting our industry, as well as kind of innovations that that's bringing with it.
Rejuvenating.
There you go. Better word, rejuvenating our business. I like that. Obviously, Dror, it'd be good to start with a bit about your background, but I know you've just been over in London talking about your new book, Rethinking Real Estate, co-chair of ULI's Tech and Innovation Council. You've set up your own businesses. So slightly different background, the typical person I have on a podcast. So it'd be great to hear a little bit about that before we get into the meat of it.
Sure. So I spent the bulk of my career, 10 years in China, working for a large developer, a Dutch company, developing residential, office, and shopping malls all over the country, in total about 3 million square meters, 30 million square feet. I started on the marketing side, so really helping give the company its name, build its first website, put together the early marketing material and presentations, then ended up overseeing the leasing and the marketing of our commercial projects. Then found myself mostly just doing acquisitions and dispositions, so either buying land from the government or selling whole commercial projects or pieces of them to large institutional investors, whether from the US and Europe or from China and Asia. I arrived into the world of real estate from the world of online media, so building websites, putting together online marketing campaigns, did more and more of that for real estate clients until one of them decided to take over my life completely. And when I tried to escape out of the industry about 5 years ago, I founded a startup that built a location-based social network. Long story short, it didn't go too well, but it pointed me back towards real estate and at how different software and later hardware as well could impact the value of a building and how it is operated and the experience that it provides to the people within it. So these days, I mostly advise large real estate owners and investors about all sorts of innovations that impact the value of their properties.
Great. I'm sure everyone's interested in getting to the tech side of this, but from my point of view, what we find more and more with our corporate occupier clients is that they understand that tech is disrupting business and disrupting whatever industry they're in. It is a business-driven phenomena. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding that the real estate, at least from the occupier's point of view, how do I say this, is lagging perhaps in the way it thinks about what that disruption is doing and why, and is struggling to have the right data sets and data points to explain what it should be doing, given how tech is disrupting its business. So maybe if we start with the inside of the buildings, as it were, so the space that occupiers take, could you maybe talk a little bit about this idea that technology is changing the way in which we should be thinking about what we do?
Definitely. So currently, I mean, we're doing this remotely, not because of the coronavirus, just because we're on two sides of the world, but we're currently undergoing the largest remote work experiment in human history. So we just had China for the last month working from home with, you know, 300 or 400 million people every day on video calls, working that way. And now we're starting to see that in the West with the, here in the US, you know, just yesterday, Google announced that 100,000 of its US employees are encouraged to stay home, and more companies are doing that. So we're seeing that work is not done in the old way of everyone sitting in the same place next to people who are very similar to them, have the same level of education, fulfilling the same tasks in a repetitive way. It's really being done in much more dynamic ways. And to a large extent, a lot of it not necessarily can be done from home, but has to be done in all sorts of different spaces. Even throughout a single day, creative work needs to be done in different spaces. So the old office of, you know, rows of desks that assume that people have similar needs seems to be disappearing quickly. So the workforce today is much more diverse in terms of age, in terms of different backgrounds, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of gender, and most importantly, I think, in terms of tasks and activities. So today, when you look at teams in some of the most innovative and fastest growing companies in the world, such as Google or Spotify or Amazon, often they include 5 or 6 different people, and each one comes from a very different discipline. So one could be a software engineer, one could be a hardware engineer, one could be a product designer, one could be a product manager, one could be a data scientist. Sometimes you have even anthropologists or psychologists on such teams. So the diversity of the teams themselves and the way each of them works is very, very different from what we used to see in mainstream companies 20 years ago or 50 years ago. And the office has to evolve to reflect that.
Well, maybe we can talk about how it's evolving to reflect that. Because I, as you say, irrespective of the virus, I think people for the last few years have been working from anywhere more and more. So obviously one of the disruptive factors is technology is changing what we do in the office. So as you just said, we don't have to come to the office to work. So why do we have to come to the office at all? What's going on in the office now that we don't need to be in it to do our daily grind?
So I can start kind of from the end, from the big vision. I see the office of the future not as a place, but as a solution, as a productivity solution, which means you enable me to give my employees access to whatever they need in order to be as productive and as happy as possible. And that might mean the ability to access different spaces, different locations, could be within a building or a network across the city or across different countries. It means all sorts of other wellness solutions and things that make them feel comfortable and also that draw them together and help them engage with each other and helps me set the tone culturally of what this company is, particularly in such a time where oftentimes employees are not all locked together and they're all very different and you need to build that kind of shared set of values and clear narrative that everyone can get behind. I think an interesting parallel can be found in the world of movie production. So, you know, increasingly humans are going to do the things that only humans can do, which means stuff that is more creative, less structured, less repetitive. Now, in the creative industries in Hollywood, this is what they've been doing for a while now, for almost 100 years. And when you look at how that's being done, you see the rolling credits at the end of a film. You see hundreds of people that are coming together to work on a project, sometimes for a long time, you know, for a year and a half or 2 years. Somebody pays, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to put it all together. So it's a big business. And usually each of them has a very unique and narrow and exotic field of expertise. And each of them works for a separate company or at least for dozens of separate companies. And they come together, they work on something, they create something, and then they let it go and they disperse back to wherever they came from. And then they come together again, possibly with some other people to work on their next project or their next product. So I think increasingly, more and more work in other industries will be completed in the same way. And the spaces that accommodate it have to reflect that.
So if you take that analogy one step further, the office becomes the movie set, I guess, because that's where people congregate. They can do some of their work in their own studios, which could be at home, could be somewhere else, but they come together for a period of time to shoot and reshoot the movie. And that means that the space that they need to work in is going to be very different to what we see now. Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, even a movie, such an extreme example, still needs physical space. Even the cloud needs physical space. You know, Amazon this year leased or acquired more space for its cloud services than WeWork did. So all of these things require physical space, but they also mean that the work itself is being completed in, you know, dozens of different ways. Each one requires a different setting, sometimes for the same people as well. So just sitting in the same place doing the same thing is just not the way work is being done anymore. And an additional factor that makes life complicated for occupiers is that in the past, the occupier, the landlord, and the lender all had a similar interest to have a long lease for the building and to know everything as far in advance as possible in terms of their costs and their spending. Today, it's becoming harder and harder for tenants to predict their headcount 18 months out, let alone, you know, 5 or 10 years. So their interests are no longer aligned with those of the landlords. They want that flexibility, which doesn't mean that they just want to pay by the desk or, you know, go month to month, but they want to know that they have that ability to scale up or scale down relatively easily and in a streamlined way whenever they need it. So instead of kind of having to become their own brokers and find someone to sublet an office every few months, they just want a solution that does that easily.
Yeah, you're right. And I think it's very difficult to imagine how that is possible, given that landlords build space. And if you've got to have expansion space for clients, then you've got a void and then you haven't got any rent coming in. But are you seeing any examples of how landlords are coping with that very real need?
So we can start in other worlds outside of the office. You know, in the residential market, the average lease is, I don't know, a year and a half or something, and people manage with it. In hotels, the average lease is 2 or 3 days, and people manage with that as well. I think the crux of the matter and the key to the challenge of how to adapt to that is in the fit out and the build out of the space. And how do you make that something that, assuming the tenant wants to scale up or down, you can repurpose the space very, very quickly, sometimes maybe even overnight for someone else to use it, whether it is for a longer period or for a shorter period. And on that front, definitely the way we currently design and build offices is not aligned with where the industry is going, I think. Like, you know, if it does take you 6 months every time between the other tenants leaving and then destroying everything and then rebuilding everything and then figuring out, you know, all the different contractors that are involved and then moving the new tenant in, it is too long. And financially, it doesn't make sense. I think in terms of the environment and sustainability, it also doesn't make sense. So I think the key opportunity for people looking to serve the occupier is to help streamline these gaps. I can't say that I've seen like a magic solution for it, but we are seeing more and more things that are built to suit, whether it is the old style of built to suit or it's the new style of, you know, new operators such as the WeWorks of the world or the Office Group, or even some landlords that are starting to offer more and more prepackaged products as opposed to, you know, customized build outs. And it started with very small customers and, you know, from the single person on a desk to, you know, 5 people or 10 people. But increasingly, we're seeing companies with 50 to 100 employees starting to become comfortable with these type of solutions because of the flexibility that it provides them. So, you know, if they know that they can sign for only 2 years or three instead of 10, they're happy to have a little less control over certain aspects in order to get that.
So I guess what I'm thinking when you say that is that so many companies today feel the need to fit out the space. So you have the architect in, the designers, the space planners, and they come up with something that reflects the brand of the business and copes with that particular business and that particular part of its growth cycle and produces the right type of space. And what you're talking about is having more or less within certain parameters something quite similar, room for desks, conference rooms, whatever it happens to me. You could almost, and that's the sort of, I guess, for me, the residential analogy, you know, you need your bedroom, your living room, your kitchen, your bathroom, but that, you know, doesn't vary, size, colors change, but.
Yeah, and you can still give your apartment its own character with the stuff you bring into it, naturally.
Right, so. Typically you spend less on that than the rest of it. So you're suggesting, I think, that in a way to solve the problem, landlords almost need to be fitting out, say, use the word generic, and it's not quite generic, but generic enough space that any occupier will see the benefit of taking that on a short-term basis over the loss, if you like, of the brand recognition and designing it themselves. And
so
maybe
I see
they gain in speed and they gain in cost. Is that where you think it might go? And is that technology driving that?
I think there's two things happening in parallel, which we see in a lot of other industries. We're seeing a bifurcation of the market. So on the one side, you have the Googles and Amazons of the world who are very large. They almost acquire their own buildings in some cases. They're very particular about how they fit them out and how they operate them. They have very large corporate real estate departments that take care of that. On the other end of the spectrum, you're seeing small tenants, but increasingly large, that are expecting this kind of off-the-shelf turnkey solution. Now, to provide that well and to enable that little enclave of the market to become bigger and bigger and address larger tenants, I think new solutions will have to be developed. So the easy way is, yes, the landlord can build some generic space, but I think further down the line, I think we will have to see kind of the convergence between fit-out and furniture, so more and more things that are easy to move around, that can be reused, that are modular in terms of how they're designed, and allow customers to give the place character and definitely to move it around to be as functional as possible, but that kind of come and bridge that gap between, okay, I'm just going to build exactly what I want and spend 6 months or 12 months on it, and, you know, I'm just going to take whatever's there, and, you know, even if I don't like it. I think there's a lot of room to do things in between, and companies are experimenting with it. Again, I think the world of furniture actually might come to the rescue on that front. In terms of how technology drives it, so there's a few ways. I think within the office itself, I mean, there's more and more sensors and things that allow you to, you know, understand how people use the space and what they need and what they don't need, both for yourself and also as a designer and landlord, to understand what the average tenant wants and kind of what would cover 80% of cases. There's more and more software in the hands of the tenants and the end users that allows them to access spaces as necessary and to book things, which means that they don't need to like keep them for themselves all the time and just sit on them even when they're not used, but they can just replace ownership or control for access. And I think more broadly, technology's biggest impact is not inside the office, but it's really in the way it destabilizes the whole world of work, like the way it destabilizes the general economy, which makes it harder for companies to predict things longer time. We also live in a unique time in history where being successful as a company might mean that you'll actually employ less people in a year or in 5 years, because you might be able to replace them with all sorts of other things that are cheaper for you. So the kind of linear equation of the last 50 years based on industrial manufacturing of, like, you know, the bigger I am, the more employees I am, and kind of the more space I need per employee, is now becoming much more complex. So I think technology is attacking and destabilizing the industry from different directions.
So there's a couple of points in there that I could pick up on, and sort of working backwards almost. But in the terms of the business model, I think what you're saying, which I'd agree with, is that the business models that companies now operate to are, you know, you're lucky if you have a business plan for a year. You might have a strategic plan that goes mm-hmm. 2 to 3 years out. But what you do know is things are changing so rapidly, you really don't know where you'll be in terms of size, scale, location over the next few years, except where things are stable. There's always a part of a business that is stable, but there's a bigger and bigger part, it seems to me, is growing in one area and shrinking in another. So it seems to me what you're suggesting is that, given that lack of regular continuity that you can see, you need to design space, or at least take space, that allows you to grow, shrink, change, work in different ways pretty quickly. Is that right?
Yes. And even the companies that are doing well, let's say Microsoft today, 5 years ago, the core business that is driving its growth today, which is its cloud business, barely existed. It was well behind its other competitors. So even if it grew the way it assumed it would grow, it grew with completely different people who have to be located in a completely different place to work on completely different things. So even for these guys, it's becoming very, very hard to predict, let alone a company with, you know, 20 employees or 100 employees, which are the bulk of office spaces in many cities. I think in London, I don't remember the number, but I think 80% or something of leases are all 10,000 square feet or smaller.
Right.
So most of these companies are not as stable as the Microsoft or Amazons or, you know, General Electrics of the world. And on the other hand, it's not as difficult to accommodate them with some flexibility, you know, because they do need a plug-and-play solution for a relatively small number of people. So it's definitely within reach for operators and landlords.
And I think
to provide a better service.
Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah, so I think on those, if we just focus on that, because I think it's a really interesting point, that if the majority of leases are in that 10,000 square feet bracket, you can see a way in which you could be designing, which was the second point I was going to go to, it's data. It seems from an occupational point of view, we've had very limited and poor data in terms of what's going on inside the office space and how often people come to the office and what they do when they get there and all that stuff that is now beginning to come through. With that, with a better data set or better data sets, it seems to me that you're onto something when you say you could probably start designing space that mm-hmm. a majority of those 10,000 square feet or less customers would like to take. So, which is a bit maybe back to your residential analogy, you kind of know if they want one, two, or three bedrooms, and you can have a mix of all of that, and it gives you the ability in the same building to scale up and scale down. And if that's true, that seems to me it's almost pushing the onus on doing this back onto the landlord from a design point of view to actually come up with what maybe the occupier hasn't already figured out that they need. But that's obviously a big risk from a landlord's point of view. But is that the direction you could see it shifting?
Yes, I think it's falling on the landlord, but it's already clear that most landlords don't really want to grab it once it falls.
Right.
So someone else has to step in between, which is why we see all these new operators growing so quickly. So again, both the co-working companies and also companies such as Cushman and others that are increasingly stepping in and doing more than they traditionally did in order to bridge that gap. So anywhere between helping the tenants a little more and doing more handholding and coordination to actually offering almost, you know, turnkey solutions and becoming almost like a flexible office operator or even fully a flexible office operator, because that's what the tenants want. And the tenants can't do it themselves in many cases, and the landlords are not willing to do it. So someone has to step in, and there's an opportunity there. And I think within that opportunity, there's other opportunities for smaller companies to come and help, let's say Cushman, with innovative furniture, with innovative build-out processes, with innovative kind of tracking of utilization technologies to help streamline that whole process and make it, as you know, as fast as possible and make the numbers work. Because at the moment, I think the world is still trying to figure out who pays for what and how to deliver what tenants want in a way that is financially viable.
Right.
But the fact that it's not financially viable yet will not change the tenant's mind. I mean, that's what they need. They're not able to, you know, sign a 10-year lease. So everyone else has to figure out how to deliver that and make money from it.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with you. And I let's come back. You've mentioned furniture a couple of times, so maybe that's an interesting thing to talk about. But before we do, just I think that what we're saying is that the data that we're now able to collect using whatever technology that it is through apps or through sensors and the IoT and all of that allows us maybe to have a much better handle on what, if you like, majority of occupiers need in a space, which therefore allows someone, and it may not be the landlord, as you just suggested, to build that space. And as you say, that's a very neat explanation of why co-working has suddenly taken our world by storm in the last few years. And that hopefully gives us the type of space we want and the environment in which we want to work. But then if we go to the layer below that, which is the furniture layer, talk a little bit more about what your point is around furniture. Are you suggesting that the furniture designers are not producing what is needed today, or is it a different point?
I don't know if they're not producing what is needed. I think there are more things that are different that are also needed. So it's not necessarily a criticism of the existing stuff. It's just like pointing out that there's a gap. So one of the hottest startups now in this space, you know, there's a company called Room, which just builds this basically really nice phone booth, essentially. And their sales are going through the roof just because they developed a very simple product that is cheap enough, built from nice materials, and that kind of looks cool. And there's more and more companies buying them because there's kind of a missing piece in their current layout. So, I mean, these companies to begin with were not willing to build too many meeting rooms or private rooms because it was too complicated and too costly, and they knew that they're not going to stay for too long. But on the other hand, the open space plan that they have doesn't allow that level of privacy that is necessary for a lot of conversations, or even just the level of quiet that employees need sometimes to just go and work on something. So in seeing that kind of, you know, phone booth, which is simple enough, but suddenly exploding in popularity. And I think we are going to see, and I know some people are working on that, other things that are a little larger than that, that, you know, almost like a mini meeting room or like a mini office, or things that can be moved around, that can be built, you know, can be packed and shipped and kind of built up and folded relatively easily to make life easier for the brokers and for the landlords and for the occupiers themselves, and to maintain that level of dynamism. And by the way, tenants, even if they stay for 10 years, I think today they need to change their own layouts much faster and much more often than before, which is another issue. So it's not just about moving in or out. It's also for the occupier themselves to have that flexibility. Because, I mean, to have the data today is wonderful, but you have to be able to respond to that data. You know, if you're locked into a floor plan for 10 years and you learn something amazing after 6 months, you have to be able to respond after 6 months and not after 5 years or whatever your budget is for in terms of, you know, how you draw the expenses for fit out.
Yeah. And I was using one of those stand-up phone booths yesterday at a client's office, and it was great. It's very soundproof. And I thought, you know, you could move this. So if they moved after up a floor, down a floor to another building, of course they can take that with them. And I think that's part of your point, having flexible enough furniture. And it's the pop-up concept. And if it's a pop-up and you can take it with you, then you can write it off over the over a longer period of time. You know, it's not something that's only written off over the life of the lease, because you can reuse it. And so that saves a considerable sum of money.
Yeah, and retail actually offers a few lessons, I think. I mean, one, the big picture, you know, that physical retail still matters, but it's becoming more of an accessory to a whole network of online services. So you have to actually convince people to come to the store. And I think increasingly you'll have to convince people to come to the office. It will be your flagship, the way, the place where you, you know, display your brand, where you help employees learn about your values. But it will be optional whether they want to go there or not. And you will have to draw them in if you want them to go there. And I think in terms of the build out, we're seeing more and more shopping mall and shopping center operators and owners starting to offer, and beyond the traditional pop-up, really converting larger stores into something that would enable tenants to stay for a shorter period. So they're experimenting with all sorts of ways of, you know, building these movable partitions and setting up all sorts of infrastructure that is easy to reuse and move around and recalibrate without kind of, you know, bringing it back to bare shell condition and each tenant doing whatever they want and taking 3 or 4 months for it. So there's definitely other places in real estate where these solutions exist. And I think the office will increasingly look to those places to come up with ideas.
And it jives nicely with your film set analogy, because of course you're building the film set for that scene or that part of the movie. And then as soon as you're onto the next part of the film, you might need a different location. You might need a different film set in the same location. So
and there are,
the idea,
yeah, go on. Like an important point, I think, when we look at the film industry, it doesn't mean that the whole physical infrastructure has to change every time. Actually, a lot of these places, a lot of the people who work in these projects, you know, they work in an editing room and in a sound room and in all sorts of specialized spaces that remain constant. They don't need to be fitted out every time. They just need to be accessed by different people on different periods of the day or of the year. So a lot of the physical infrastructure can remain the same. And a lot of the solution is also about how you enable people to access what they need whenever they need it and then let go of it for other people to use when they don't need it. So, which is the other alternative, and I think we'll see both. So both some large physical spaces becoming more flexible in themselves, and also the access to different spaces becoming more streamlined and easy for people, so that they wouldn't have to rebuild their own office every time they have some special project, but that they could easily access the physical space and the infrastructure that they need nearby, or, you know, with enough ease that it becomes better than just building it yourself every time.
Yeah. Drew, we could be talking about this for hours, but maybe just to wrap things up, I was thinking about this whole use of technology, which we all find fascinating, in a way is driving people away from the office,
mm-hmm.
because we can work anywhere and we don't have to work in a physical space. Yet there's more and more technology coming out, which is helps us navigate ourselves around an office, find out where our colleagues are. So in a way, the technology is doing both sides of the coin. What do you see as the, and you mentioned headquarters building, but what's going to bring people to an office building in the future? And how is technology going to help do that? Or should technology be helping us do that? Or is it just this pure human interaction, which we obviously don't need technology for?
So there's two things. I mean, one, you know, they say in the past, you went to the office, you had access to state-of-the-art things that you didn't have access to at home, you know, to a computer, to an elevator, to air conditioning. Today, most people, the consumer world is outpacing the enterprise world. Yeah. So most people have better stuff at home yep. than they do in the office, and better toys to play with. So I think one thing is to make sure that the offices are at least up to par in terms of the, again, the digital and physical experience. And the second, I think, which I'm personally more more fond of, I think a lot of the things that will draw us back to the office are probably not about technology. They're about the things that are actually becoming rarer or more precious in a world that is mediated by technology. So it's, you know, the clean air and the access to organic materials or to interaction with people and the ability to be active and stay healthy. So again, access to all sorts of things that are more and more precious and harder to find in the general urban landscape. I think if the office can provide that to us and really be the most pleasant and rejuvenating place, and yeah, that word again, for our own well-being, I think we will go to it because we will feel happier and more productive there. And technology has a lot of like little roles to play in facilitating that, again, measuring it and making sure that everything works properly. But ultimately, to the end user, the experience should feel like there's no technology at all. It should feel as natural as possible, just like going to a place that makes you feel pleasant and that reduces your stress levels and that allows you to focus and produce your best work and also to want to come back the next day.
Great. And that's a whole nother topic, wellness, productivity, mm-hmm. And maybe we'll get to that on the next podcast. But Drew, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I really appreciate all your insights. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Good talking to you.